Welcome, everyone. We're going to get started. So my name's Roger Gilchrist, and my colleague here is Darren Liu. We actually work for the CRM R&D team, but we work in a team that engages with our customers. And just to put this in context, we're going to talk to you about some of the best practices and some of the things we see, but although we're from R&D, so we know where we're trying to drive the products and what the purpose of the product features are and capabilities are, we aren't coming from the ivory tower of that. We are definitely coming from the field. We work with our biggest customers around the world. I cover the EMEA region. Darren covers North America and some of the China customers. But our role is to really make sure our customers are successful, that they use the software, they can get advantage from the software, they understand where we're going. But the other part of our role is to make sure we can feed back to our team where customers are having problems and where things aren't quite as good as they should be. So I do want to put that in context. This isn't kind of purist guidance of the ivory tower world. This is very much real world experiences. So we're going to break it into two areas. Darren's going to talk about approaches from a project point of view and a process and approach point of view, and then hand back to me to talk about some of the architectural concepts and some of the things that we see that people commonly mistake or things that have quite big impacts if they get them wrong. So at that point, I'll hand over to Darren.
Thank you, Roger. Can everybody hear me okay? Awesome. All right. This is a session we're trying to make it fun. So I mean, we're going to actually reserve some time after the session. So you can actually come ask us questions, and we're happy to answer all those questions for you. So I mean, when it actually comes to project implementation, it is not an easy topic sometimes because there's a lot of best practices for implementing a dynamic CRM project, especially dynamic CRM online. Right? Some of those things that I'm going to actually go through might be common sense to you, but I mean, what I hope out of this session is if you can get one or two things out of our sessions, I would really appreciate that you can actually take it on back to your project or your customer. So maybe before I start, raise your hand if you are a solution integrator here. Awesome, okay. Maybe a customer? Just someone new to Dynamics CRM? Okay, a few, okay. We try and actually go as slow as possible, and then you can actually learn. All right, so I mean, when we actually start with our Dynamics CRM implementation, right? Dynamics CRM, and people are asking, hey, what is Dynamics CRM? Usually when you start with an enterprise company with a small department, right? And then they might be starting Dynamics CRM really small. And however, a couple of guys starting configuring Dynamics CRM. However, you know, once you show this Dynamics CRM products to the business is going to be like, hey, this is awesome. I want to actually add more to it. And then the small project slowly becomes a bigger project. I don't know if it applies to any one of the scenarios, but this is what I've seen from other customers, right? And when also doing the implementation with a customer. So once the small child becomes a teenager, right? And then becomes an adult, right? And then they actually requires a lot of people and team to actually make it successful, right? So. And then one thing that we have seen, right, from our project implementation is leadership. So some of the common issues that we have seen from the leadership topic is that sometimes it's like when you get bigger, a leadership role is not often defined correctly, or maybe not have someone as a lead, or maybe not have the sponsor that actually sponsors that project. So, and also that, a lot of the goals that you're trying to accomplish, right, and then there's not clearly communicated to the project team and as well as the business. Didn't set the right expectation. So for this topic, right, and then here are some of the recommendations that what we have seen is that a project manager is the guy that usually glues everybody together, glues the team together, right? And that project manager needs to be on site on a daily basis to work with the business, work with the customer, right, work with the end user as well as the project team to actually make the project to be successful. Right, and then for this leadership, I mean, there are more best practices. However, sometimes when there's issues happen, right, what would you do, right? And then this project manager or the leadership role needs to have a clear escalation path. So escalate to the project sponsor, the account team from the Microsoft side, the customer side, or even the solution integrator, right? So we can actually get the issue addressed as quickly as possible. Right. I mean, there are more, but I mean, these are the things that we have seen from my previous implementations, as well as some of the best practices that I highly suggest our customer, right, and take it if you can, and back to your project. Right. Okay, moving on, and planning. So I mean, some of the things is planning is really straightforward, right? I mean, you can think of a planning. However, there's a lot of details in the planning, right? So I don't know if you have experience. I always actually come in a deal, right, and on a project, and our account team trying to actually win the project, right? Not like our account team, but applies to everybody as well. And then they underestimate, you know, the scope of work, right? And then trying to win the project. At the end of the day, when the project team taking over and starting doing the implementation, and then, you know, they say, oh, you know what? We have a lot more work than we can actually finish in the expected timeline, right? So first of all, you need to really define the scope and then sign off prior to, you know, starting the project, right? And then also, I work with customers that they try to accomplish the entire CRM project in a month. And then a lot of questions that I got from our customers, hey, you know, dynamic CRM is in the cloud. You can actually easy implement, easy configure, right? But we actually get the scale at a very big scale, and it actually takes time to plan. And it actually, also that it takes time to implement. So I mean, right here, I would like to, you know, emphasize that make sure that you have a realistic timeline for your project. And then once you have a realistic timeline for your project, right, and then you execute that, you know, project plan, and then it's going to be more successful, right? And then also in the planning phase, there is staffing is also important, right? So especially new to dynamic CRM, you know, there's a lot of the customers that I work with, they think that, oh, you know what, let's have a .NET developer, right, and then they actually help with the implementation. Yes, you can actually leverage a developer to actually do development. However, engage someone who has the knowledge, right, and has the skill set to really know the application will actually help you quite a bit in the very beginning. You know, understand that, you know, in the very beginning, you might involve with that dynamic CRM expert for a duration of time, and then slowly you may be able to transition, you know, educate your team, your .NET developers, so you can actually take on more work on dynamic CRM. So, but for your planning, you need to actually plan, you know, based on the scope of work that you agree to, and also the project timeline, right? And then you need to actually plan the resource accordingly, so, okay? And the best practice here, I pointed out that, you know, the devil is in the details. So, I mean, in the very beginning, don't just look at the high-level scope, right, on the business requirement, but maybe go a level deeper to explore, you know, with your end user, your business, to understand what are some of the requirements that are there, right? Yeah, I think I discussed this, I'll talk about all the best practices indicated right here, right? Come up with a project plan with a realistic timeline. So I have a customer that actually trying to actually do a project that's a year in 3 months. So you can imagine how the project went, right? All right, and then let's go into a little bit more detail about project initiation. So I mean, this is also a planning phase. So the common issue that we have seen is that once you have, you know, you try to start the project, you jump in the project immediately, start your development right away. So usually, you know, I have seen that is probably not going to be successful if you're going to be jumping into it right away. You know, I know that you want to actually start going into configuring the system. I know that you want to actually start showing your business, hey, what are some of the system can do, right, and try to actually finish the project. However, you know, also in the planning phase, especially for, you know, a CRM implementation with, a, you know, online implementation, on-premise implementation with a larger size, larger scale, right? You need to actually do some more planning. I call it project initiation. So what do we do in a project initiation phase? So usually what we do is we have to agree on an implementation methodology, right? Usually it's agile or iterative, and then some companies do want to actually go with waterfall. But whatever works for your project or your team, whatever that you're most comfortable with, but what we have seen from all of our projects, right, and the implementation methodology, iterative works the best. Because agile, you can see, agile is just like 2 week short sprint, right, and then it's going to, some people is not able to actually get used to the speed of agile. So I think that iterative, you can actually define your duration. You know, usually it's 4 weeks, and then you can actually really gather a requirement as well as development of the system and actually show the system to the end user to gather them feedbacks, right? And then also take the project initiation time to go through the project plan as well as the timeline, roles, and responsibility with the project team. This is important so everybody can be on the same page, so everybody knows what to do throughout the project, right? And then some of the points I pointed out here is jump into development too fast, not having the proper environment. So on premise, right, you can actually spin up like your own CRM environment, and you'll be able to create your own instances, right? But for CRM online, you really need to plan out your environment, right? How many environments that you're gonna have for your development, for your testing, for your QA, for your performance testing, as well as for your production. So you need to work with your account team. So I mean, for online, by default, you're gonna get one production environment and one sandbox environment for free, right? And you can actually purchase additional sandbox instances for your project. However, plan it ahead of time and also plan your storage space, because you're gonna get 5 gigs of store space by default, right? However, that might not be enough if you're gonna be having a lot of data in your environment, right? So all those storage spaces being shared by everybody, every tenant, every organization that's in your tenant. So plan out your environment here. And also, in project initiation phase, that I emphasize that, is that you need to really look into your release process. What it means is how you're gonna actually deploy from one environment to another environment, right? From another environment to another environment, so we can have an approach. It will actually save you a lot more time if you're gonna actually do this planning up front, and then rather to deal with all the different issues. Because we have seen issues from customers that they make changes in all the different environments, and it ended up that they would have to actually fix all the environments. It will actually spend a lot of time in fixing them. So I think this is some of the project initiation activities that I would like to point out. And there are more, but I mean, these are the most important ones that I've seen customer or some of the solution integrators that we're not doing, right? So that's why I want to point out to the audience here. Okay. All right, so I think that review the implementation assumptions, and I already talked about the methodology approach, right? So get an agreement from your team, right? From your solution integrators. Everybody has, I think there's, Microsoft has their Microsoft Sure Step methodology that's available, right? And then with other SIs, they have their own methodology. But I mean, when you look at the methodology, they're all similar, right? And then I think that what we have said before is that the iterative methodology seems to work well for the dynamic CRM implementation. I've seen it in multiple customers that actually works really well. When you actually want to get used to the iterative approach, right, and if you want to actually move faster, you can actually try, after you have the team that's in place for your project, the people that's already familiar with how you actually do, meaning the machine's running well, and then you can actually go look into see if there's any way that you can do it faster, looking at the Agile approach. Okay? Right, so I think I touched the points that are on this slide already. Right, so I think next topic I want to move is the architectural foundations. Just like you're building a house, you need a good foundation, right, before you actually move on to building things on top of it. Right, so if you don't have a good foundation, you're going to be, a lot of headaches after you don't have a good foundation for your house, right? So here are some of the things that I would like to point out, right, for architectural foundation items. So most importantly for dynamic CRM is the instance strategy, right? So how many instances that you're going to have? Some customers, they might have a single instance for their one organization, right? They may have like offices or departments that's across the world. They might need to figure out what's the instance strategy first, right? Because that's really the foundational item side. If we're gonna have all the business process in a single instance, or I'm gonna have like a separate instance taking care of the other department's business processes, right? And then the other thing is security model, right? I think that this is a common topic if you've done implementations, dynamics implementation, and then the security model is important. So you're gonna be accessing a business unit level, or you're gonna be having kind of ownership of the record that you need to figure out ahead of time in order for you to be successful, right? And then that's another foundation component items, right? Also data migration, right? And also data integration strategy is important because you need to actually figure out how to extract the data out and how to actually input the data in, right? And then one thing that I would like to actually point out here is really the data model. Because I think the data model is a foundational component of everything, right, of the entire solution. So usually on a lot of projects, right, the customer and solution integrator, they're still changing the data model day before they go live, which is very risky. Okay, you're trying not to actually do that, okay? So if you can, in the very beginning, maybe in just first iteration of your project, try to focus on your data model, right? And then get it up to 90% or 95%. And after that, put it in a change management process for adding attributes and changing entities. Because you can see the data model, your integration relies on it, your data migration relies on it. So there's a lot of component related to the data model, and I would like to point out that it's important that you need to actually lock down your data model as soon as possible, put it in a change process, right? Lastly, right, for the architectural foundation component, because we are going to the cloud right now, going to Dynamics CRM Online, right? How to do single sign-on, how to actually get the Dynamics CRM Online work with your internal identity, right, authentication, sometimes requires some time to figure it out. It's also a component that you need to figure out ahead of time because, as you know, that all your integration sometimes you're going to be authenticated with Dynamics CRM. How are you doing it, right? And then this is like the first thing you need to figure out before you actually try to figure out down the road. If you're going to try to figure out down the road, and then ended up, you're going to be, spend more time in fixing the issue here. Okay? All right, analysis. So, there's never-ending analysis. This is going in analysis paralysis stage, right? So, I don't know if you have done it, share the same feeling that I had right here. But the thing here is, the customer is all analysis at one after another, meeting after another meeting. So, don't spend too much time on it, right? You need to spend time, but spend enough time on it, but get the project started, and then the idea here is hey, you know what? Get the system in front of your customer. You can actually see the system, right? Then they can actually know what are the things that you're talking about. If you don't show them the system, right, they will not know. If you're gonna be traditional .NET development and they probably waterfall approach, they're not gonna see the system at the very end, right? So I think that is good for your analysis stage. Show them the system, educate them on it so they know what you are talking about, right? And then also, for especially starting your project fresh from the beginning, right? And do a high-level planning, your deployment plan, right? And a release plan, I would call it a release plan, where you're gonna lay out, what's the first release is gonna be, the second release is gonna be, right? So you can actually have your leadership team show it to your business, so we get all your end user and your business excited. They know, what's gonna be in the release one that is coming, and then that's what's gonna be in release two, what features and what additional functionality is gonna add. So I think this get the business excited of what's gonna be coming, but for the first release, I would suggest that, select the top 3 to 5 business scenarios that you can actually chew, right? And then implement those 3 to 5 scenarios flawlessly, right? And really show off this application, and then you can slowly add on top of it, right? One of the problems, too much too soon, because everybody, I want everything, right? But if you want everything, right, it actually impacts the quality, the top project timeline. So I think that, especially using this iterative method, right, you can actually release something to the end users, and they can start using it, address the business problems, right? And then you can add more in the future releases, right? And then I think the best practice I pointed out, analysis should be combined process requirement, utilizing a system to demonstrate, right, to begin form understanding of software terms and client business terms, right? It's basically show the end user, so the business analysis, the analyst, the environment, so they can actually learn about the Dynamics CRM environment, Dynamics CRM software. Because it's easy, because you can actually just go online and spin up a trial instance, you can immediately get access to the environment, right? And then also here, allow time to iterate on requirements during the analysis phase, right? Make sure requirements are not mixed with design, because I've seen a lot of documents, they says requirement documents. However, I see a lot of design, a lot of hows into the requirement document. So when you're actually doing analysis, gathering the requirement, focus on what the business really wants, instead of how to actually get it done. Because there's different ways of skinning the cat, right? And then there's different design approaches. That should be in your design document, right? For the project, okay? Okay, I think I cover this slide pretty much in my previous discussions. Don't boil the ocean on release one, right? And then build the new solution differently than the way that legacy was built, right? And then it takes time to improve the entire system, right? And then also, like I said, release one, let it be stabilized on a foundational solution first. Release one could be a solution, make it stable, right? And the user, because it's change management for the users as well, changing from the old system to the new system, they need time to get used to it, right? They need time to use it and learn it, right? And then that give them time, allowing them to actually adapt to the new system, and they can actually provide feedbacks. And then another release, what you can do is you can actually enhance the system, right? And then after this, it will actually reduce the overall ownership of the entire project and the entire solution, right? I think customization, right? The common issues are too much too soon, right? And then a lot of things that we went into is like, my old system didn't like this, you know? I want my old system back, and then you try and actually fit the entire old system into the new system, right? So, I mean, for customizations, I would highly suggest that see if you can actually stick with out-of-the-box functionality as much as possible, right? And then build reusable components whenever it's possible, right? And then, like I said, use the system for 3 to 6 months, begin making additional modifications to the system so the user can actually get used to the system, learn the system, get the feedback, and provide it to you, right? And then I'm going to actually talk about a little bit about deployment and application lifecycle management, right? And then a lot of these projects that I've seen, they don't know where the truth is, source of truth. You know, the source of truth is always should be in your TFS. However, they don't know, you know, they don't know how to actually do it. But there are other sessions that's available at Ignite, right? I think Matt Barber is going to have a session on application lifecycle management. So I think that I highly suggest that you attend his session on ALM, right? So not having ALM in place, right? And then also, you know, they don't have a release plan or a release schedule. So no one knows, hey, when are we supposed to be releasing code to your downstream environment, like your test environment, your QA environment? No one knows the schedule. So establish a schedule of when that actually release it to the downstream environment so everybody knows. And also that, you know, include the change log. So the change log meaning what is being changed each one of the builds, right? That's going to be going to your environment, right? And then also that it's important, right? That in the project initiation phase, I would highly suggest that CRM has solutions, right? Solution, you need to define a version structure ahead of time. So everybody has a clear understanding, hey, you know what, for this build, is this going to be like version 1.0.0.0, right? And the next build may be .1 and .2. So every release increment the version number. So it's going to be clear to everyone, clear to the business, clear to the development team, and then include the change log with each version, right? And then one thing that I've seen actually work well in the larger implementation is they dedicate a person instead of actually the developer who is actually writing code and also doing the solution deployment. And then, you know, on a larger deployment, that you're gonna have a lot more systems. You're gonna have a lot more things that you need to deploy. So it's highly suggested that if you can dedicate the person who only do the build and deployment. So basically compiling the code, right, gathering the solution, maybe export it, archive it, and then put it in TFS. And then also that person is responsible for, you know, pushing the solution to the downstream environments, right? This person is not only just do with the push of the buttons. You can leverage that person, right, to keep track of the data model, right? Yeah, because that guy, data model is important. Any changes to the data model, the solution deployer needs to know, right? That he may have to actually make some modifications in the system before he imports the solution, right? I think that person can actually keep track of the change log, right? The change log can be, you know, sometimes time consuming. It's a person's job to actually keep track of the differences and what's going to be changed for each one of the releases. So that's why it's highly recommended that you have a person to actually do this, right? And then important thing, make change only in a single environment. Development environment, right? And if you don't make changes in a single environment and start making changes in your test environment, QA environment, all over the place, at the end of the day, it's going to be a mess for you to fix. So that's why I highly recommend that, you know, any change, enforce a rule in your company, right, on your project, right, any change, you need to start with the lower environment and then slowly moving to the downstream environment. Then you can actually test out the entire deployment process, right? Even though you go into production, you know that my solution going from my downstream environment to my next environment will work, okay? Just like testing, right? Right, testing, right? So I think that I want to cover testing a little bit more because it's like, I have seen some of my customers that they just, hey, you know what? I finished my development of my solution. All right, I'm going live tomorrow. So I don't know if you've seen that, but I mean, usually they don't have a test strategy in place, but I think that I cannot emphasize enough that, you know, especially for Dynamics, even though it's Dynamics CRM Online implementation is easy to configure, but you need to do enough testing. You need to know what, you need to have a predictable, right, whatever is predictable in production, right? Make sure things are working, right? And then what we have seen is testing doesn't really start early. It's always the last minute, you know, the abandoned child, I would say it. They don't do testing, right? And then also that even though you test it, you don't have a regression testing plan in place. So you fixed it, okay, I push a solution, and then I forget about it, right? So you need to engage your team to make sure that you do regression, to make sure that you retest all the fixes, because your fixes could potentially break other things. Right, so I mean, some of the larger customers that I've seen, they have automated their testing, right? So every time they do a solution push, they do a smoke test, and also they do automated testing. There's tools out there that you can actually help you with automated testing. Then you don't have to actually do a lot of manual regression testing. But I just want to point out that regression testing is pretty important here. Right, and then some of these, right, it might be applying to you, might not, right? The tools that's actually recording the bugs and then triaging the defects, right? And then also, you know, for Dynamics CRM Online, right, I don't know if how many of you are experiencing performance issues, right? Performance is a big problem, but I don't think that, you know, you cannot just, you know, dismiss performance testing, because you're going to have a solution with thousands of users going to be on the system. You need to ensure that, hey, you know what, for these thousands of users, are they going to run into a performance issue or not, right? And also, the performance thing might not be focused on the application. You might need to actually look into focus on different geographic areas, because it could be a global deployment, right? Some people from China may be actually having slow performance accessing the instance in the US, and then you're gonna have to talk about what's gonna be your mitigation plan and how to address that performance issue. So I think, do talk to the account team, do talk to Microsoft, and what you can do with performance testing, right? And then also, one of the common things is that you wanna do testing, however, where are you gonna do it, you know? I hope that you're not doing your performance testing or testing in your development environment, your developers still changing code, right? I think that to have that environment ready, right, your testing environment ready is gonna be, you know, gonna help you a lot to have a separate instance for just testing, okay? Right, I think I covered all some of the best practices throughout the discussion here. So, I mean, testing strategy should be communicated prior to analysis workshop. And then your test script should be starting from your requirements session. So your tester might be able to sit into those requirements session and hearing it, and then start actually, you know, cranking out testing scripts for you. Right, and then one of the last thing that I would like to cover for, you know, Dynamics CRM implementation practice before I turn it over to Roger, is really engage Premier support. Microsoft is actually a big organization. Roger and I are from the Dynamics CRM R&D organization. So we are both solution architects and dealing with large global enterprise customers in the world. But you know, if you don't have support agreements, I would highly suggest you to look into a support agreement, talking with the technical account managers, right? Support is not necessary to be involved after you have issues. Yeah, there's proactive services our support team can offer to you that you can, you know, go along with your project journey, right, and identify issues up front and help you to mitigate and address it, right? So I think that is good to have a support involved in your project. Okay, I'm gonna actually turn it over to Roger.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you.
So what I'm gonna get into now is talk a little bit more about the more tangible architectural elements that come through. So we've been talking about the approach. What are some of the things that come up? Now, the kind of topics I'm picking here are things that customers often forget, or which they try to apply kind of downstream when it's already way too late to be able to do them effectively. So some of the things we've seen from experience that if you get right from the start will mean that you're much more likely to lead to a successful delivery and a successful project for your users. One of the first topics that I want to talk about is cloud. And this isn't just because we're banging on about cloud continuously and for any other reason, but that actually some things coming these days that I think are important to think about, and particularly from a CRM perspective, which is that a lot of conversations I've had this week have been around the fact that people aren't necessarily ready for cloud. So some things we're doing in cloud aren't relevant to them. They're not ready for them. They're not going to be ready for them for a while, or their industry isn't going to go cloud. And the one thing I say back to that in lots of ways is that doesn't mean you shouldn't design for it. even if you're not ready to go for it right now, design for it on the basis you don't really know when it's going to happen to you. And I had this experience with one big pharmaceutical customer when I was in an architectural discussion with their architects, and they were talking about the fact that in pharmaceuticals, they're not going cloud. They're never going to go cloud. It's pharmaceuticals. It's not an industry that's ready for that. And halfway through the conversation, the CIO popped his head into the workshop we were having and said, well, you've got Roger here from Microsoft. Can you please talk to him about cloud? One of the things we're thinking about, not quite ready for it yet, but one of the things we're thinking about is whether we go. And so all of a sudden, from a position of we're not going there, they very quickly were shifted to the point of, well, we need to have a conversation about it. Now, that's for a few reasons that if you get it right from the start, you're in a good position to move forward. But if you don't know what's happening, you may not be aware what's going to come around the corner for them. Now, they happen to go on for Office eventually, Office Online. They didn't happen to go CRM for a while, but they have gone online in other services for their documents and things. But I actually pitch it a different way, which is it's not really about cloud. For most of the customers I've worked with that have made the shift to cloud, they would stay there and they would follow those same practices, but they'd follow those practices whether they're working on-premises or whether they're working on cloud. And there's a reason for that, which is that it's not really about the fact that we're deploying and hosting it for you. It's more about the agility it drives. And even if you're on-premises, being agile and being able to take advantage of new features and drive new capabilities to your users is much more important than whether you happen to be hosted by us or hosted by yourselves. And the real difference about cloud is just that we enforce that. We enforce you to upgrade. So we enforce or put you in a position where, because we're constantly upgrading, you need to make sure that you stay more supported, which means you can upgrade. And if I go back to some of the big on-prem customers who are stuck in CRM 2011, CRM 4, the main reasons they're stuck there is because of all the unsupported work they've done. That is meaning that they would love to go tablet for mobile users. They would love to use things like search. They would love to use all these features that we've added since, but they can't because they can't upgrade. And that's nothing to do with being cloud, but it's about the fact that by going cloud, our other customers, on the other hand, if I go to Metrobank, for example, as an example, they upgrade every 6 months or so because they can, because they know they're going to be doing it, so they don't do anything unsupported. And it means that their cost of upgrading is really low because they know it's going to hit them if they don't. So I think one of the big things I would pitch around this is all the things we talk about going cloud is not always about cloud, but very much about that agility, which I would be very surprised if anyone in this room would say, I would like to not be agile. I would like to not take advantage of new features. I would like to be behind, because that's what you're really trying to drive. And I can't imagine anyone in this room is really saying that's where you'd like to be. It's normally that there's been something happened, like going that extra tiny little mile of saying, I'd like to make that row in a grid red. Well, actually, there's no supported way to that, so we'll just hack that one. Oh, and then we'll hack the next one and the next one. Now, all of a sudden, I can't upgrade. Now, would it be more important to have a tablet client or have that grid row red? Would you rather go to social engagement integrated naturally or Exchange server-side sync? Well, actually, I'm pretty sure most of you would rather have some of those features than those tiny little pieces there. So the one argument I would have to you is, even if you're not thinking of going cloud right now, think about some of those agility angles that cloud drives, because I think it'll lead to you for benefit. Most of us who've gone to the online space would carry on that way on premises anyway now. And there is a part of that, which is, as people are transitioning, the conversation often they have is, how do I do what I used to do in cloud? It's got all these extra constraints, but how do I do what I used to do? And one of the changes in mindset is, how do I achieve the same goals? Not how do I exactly press the same buttons to do exactly the same things. So if you stored something in the registry, well, have a think about that. Did you really need to store something in the registry? Could you not have done that in a different way through, say, plug-in secure storage? Are there other mechanisms to achieve the same goal? And that's a key thing to think about, is not get tied up on your mechanisms of the past. I do recognize you've got to achieve the goals of the past, but achieve new ones in different ways that fit better with the product. And we've done a lot of work since the old days of CRM 4 2011 to enable those difficult scenarios. And a lot of this is around just being ready to constantly upgrade. And it's not about seeing that as a tax, but it's seeing it as an opportunity, being ready to take advantage of all the new stuff that we're doing, all the new stuff that Azure's doing, things like that. And being in a position to stay supported means that you're not spending effort on upgrading. If you're staying supported, that's a much more our problem than yours in most cases. And if you do that, then you can spend the effort on adding new value, not on just keeping the lights on by keeping upgrading. But that also means that then when you do want to, say, use something like the tablet client, you can just turn it on because you're ready for it. You're in the position on the platform version to be able to do that. Which leads to another topic I want to talk about, which is, so as soon as people do go cloud, one of the most common topics we get asked about these days is, should I go multi-tenant or single-tenant with Office 365 or with CRM in an Office 365 area? And people often don't know where to start in even thinking about that. So one of the bits I wanted to talk about is kind of how I think about this and how I've had these conversations with customers in lots of different places. And the first part of this is almost stepping back from the technology and stepping back from thinking about the different working pieces, but step back to what are you trying to achieve? And in most cases for the organizations I work with, what they're really thinking about is a body of knowledge. They've got documents, they've got knowledge about customers, they've got context about their business that they have in a body that is a centralized whole that they work with. They have a group of people then that interact with that knowledge. Now, not every person interacts with all the different parts of that, but collectively, there is that group of information. Within Microsoft, we've got all the different bits we know about the different products, and I might want to know bits about multiple parts of that. There may be some bits, like HoloLens, I wasn't allowed to know about before it came out. There are some bits that around Azure and Office 365, which are pretty key to my job, that I want to go and explore about. So this isn't about necessarily meaning that everybody does have access to something, but drawing the boundary of what is the group of knowledge that people could want to have access to, and who are the group of people that may need that access, and thinking about that in a group area as kind of a context. Because then see some other customers who don't have that or have that single unified whole. Some customers do have completely disparate divisions. They have an automotive business and they have a washing machine business. And realistically, the same two people are very unlikely to be involved in those two pieces or in a material way. You may have some, like in a bank, where they've got a Swiss division and the Swiss banking rules mean that that's fundamentally kept separate from another area. But in both those cases, there's clear delineation and there's no real crossover between those people or there's no real crossover between that information. So drawing that boundary and stepping back and saying, where is the body? What is the things that we would like to know about? Who are the people that might want to know about that? Is a key part, really, of thinking about that cloud strategy. Because those are the boundaries we would typically draw around an Office 365 tenant or an online services tenant. That boundary of knowledge where a group of people could need to have access to that data is typically the boundary of where your tenant should be. And if you have got two completely disparate divisions, then maybe two tenants work. And what is a tenant in that sense? And a tenant has had confusing terminology, particularly for CRM people who have been around for a while, because before cloud started, before Office 365 decided to use the word as well, we used to mean it in a slightly different way. But as we mean it now, Office 365 tenant or online services tenant is the envelope of all the different cloud services that you might want to consume in a consistent way. So it is where you have your Azure AD, which contains all your identities and how your users are going to log on. It is your admin portal for how you manage all those services and where your licenses sit within that envelope so that you can control which users have access to which services. And then it is the wrapper around all of your dynamic services like CRM and marketing and social engagement, but also your other ones like Exchange and SharePoint and Skype. And that envelope contains that wrapper of saying this is the body of services that these people might want to work with on that body of knowledge. And in a multi-tenancy world, each of those is completely separate. We don't really intend to see that those two things would interact. You don't tend to have a user in one interacting with a mailbox in another. We do a lot of work about making sure those services will work natively and very, very seamlessly within a tenant. We don't do a whole lot of work about trying to say someone in one area can go use a mailbox in another area. And that's worth thinking about in terms of the way you design your solution. Because in most cases, for most customers, a single tenancy is the right answer. That is the default position, and I would strongly recommend people think about that as, until you've got a reason not to, go with a single tenancy. Because there will be a place where you want someone to have access to something, and by being in that tenant, it makes it very easy to give you that access. Putting people in separate tenants starts to introduce barriers. Because we work on the theory that we'll provide that single pool of users, and we'll make it easy to grant access to all the different services. A user can access his mailbox or can get access to a SharePoint site. We work on making those boundaries very seamless within a tenancy, but it's a different organization to go somewhere else. So thinking about that way, unless you get to a point you see a tangible reason not to, will give you the best chance of aligning with where we're going around that. There are variations, and often, like I say, there can be cases where completely disparate divisions with no crossover can work, But you need to recognize that a user in one is not then going to be working with CRM and integrating their mailbox across to another one. We don't make those kind of scenarios work. For those kind of scenarios, you are being treated almost as a person in a different part of the business. So it's like somebody from, say, Coca-Cola wanting to access something from a Pepsi's data set. That's just not the way it's intended to be, and that's the kind of separation we're talking about. But having said that, there is an area that we are working on around this, which is one of the scenarios, which is the idea that when an external party should get access to this. So we'll get it with Microsoft. So we've got Microsoft as a broad tenant, and we've got all of our Exchange mailboxes, and we integrate that to our CRM systems. We've got that context. And then we've got a partner, and that partner is coming in to work on one of our projects. And we've got what we call B2B authentication coming in Office 365 that will let you grant access to that person with their Office 365 logon into our tenant. But the reason I mention this one is that there is still a limitation. That is not about them becoming part of Microsoft. That is not about us suddenly being able to go and grab all of their mail from their mailbox. We should not get access to a partner's mailbox just because they're working on one of our projects. We're granting them access to the resources within our body of knowledge. We're not suddenly magically giving ourselves access to their body of knowledge. So that idea of that body of knowledge is quite important to say, this is the boundary. I might grant somebody specific access into the bits I control. I'm not suddenly granting them access outside. Now, we are going to be offering B2B with CRM later this year. It's not currently there, but it will start to enable that scenario. So there are scenarios where you can do that cross-tenancy work, but I do want to reinforce that idea that you are still keeping the interactions between services within the tenant. Anything else is about granting an outsider, effectively, access on your behalf to your knowledge, not something external. And the other one we get asked about is, well, I need to because I've got two different business divisions and they need different CRM instances, so I've got to go multi-tenant. Well, no, we're doing a lot of work around having the ability, as Darren mentioned, to have lots of different instances within CRM. So you can have multiple production instances, you can have multiple sandbox instances, and you can use those to set up completely different business divisions with development and test and QA and production for one part of your business, and the same again for multiple other areas. And we keep increasing this, but I think it's something like 50 productions, something like 75 sandbox instances. So you can have a lot of instances within the same tenant. And that gives you that separation of logic between each of those. And what does that mean? Well, an instance is actually its own separate database. There's no crossover between the databases between the different instances. So if you've got one business division, the database is limited to that. You can grant individuals access to multiple instances, but each instance is completely separate in terms of data usage. The other split is between production and sandbox. So we have production type instances, which, as the name suggests, can be used for production use. But we also have sandbox instances, which have other abilities. So the ability to reset them, the ability to copy and other instances over them. So you can copy production down and do testing. So we've got the ability to drive that kind of ALM story across the different instances. And each of those can be on different versions, which gives you the chance to stage your upgrade to systems as you go as well. So the next one I wanted to talk about is, again, something that I think got lost in translation for many people, and it's about the user experience. And we did a lot of work in CRM 2013, for any of you who have been around for a few years, about driving new user experience. Now, the way that landed for a lot of people was shiny new paint on the same toy. And it looks cooler, it's styled, and it looks prettier. And kind of missed the point, really, of what we were trying to achieve, because, yes, it was prettier, but that wasn't actually really the primary driver of why we made the change. If we step back to understand what we were really trying to derive from the user experience in CRM, was the first part of that was to try and get to insight. If you go back a few years, CRM got a really bad name in many ways, CRM generally as a concept, around the fact that CRM becomes just a system of record. What it is a tool for everyone to go in and write down what they already know. And what we're trying to drive is actually about insight rather than just data, not data storage, but actually about insight. I'll also talk about the fact that it's a more intuitive navigational flow, and we're trying to change the way that people flow through the application. Another key point is around optimizing for create and consumption, which was a goal of what we did, realizing that people have different usage patterns of the same bits of data, so trying to optimize for those things, as well as then really trying to get into more sharing, collaboration, which is increasingly important these days. So touching on that first one, as I mentioned, the past has been that CRM got treated very much as this system of record. We went out to all of our users in a business and said, I need you to tell me about what you know, because it's important I know, and it's important that if you leave the business, I know what you know, because that means that we don't lose it. And so what you're really saying to someone is, I've got this tax for on you to make me more successful. And that doesn't really buy your users into working with the system. It doesn't really encourage them to go into the user system. And I know we've seen plenty of this, but hands up, for people who are using the CRM system like that, how many people do you know have kind of say a Friday deadline when you need everything in, and everyone puts that data in on about 4:30 on a Friday afternoon? Just show of hands, does that sound familiar to people? Oh, less than I thought. I would say that's pretty common, is that people aren't going in because they want to. They're going in because they know they have to put it in, otherwise they get wrapped on the knuckles. And what we want to realize is we want to change that, which is instead of it being a system that you have to go in and do stuff, try and change it to be a system that you want to go in, because we're going to tell you something you didn't know. We're not going to just give you a place where we feed back the thing you already knew, but tell you something that's going to make it easier to do your job. Before you speak to that customer, would you like to know that he's just lost his job and therefore not try and sell him a massive loan that would potentially lead to a default? Or maybe the other way, they've just had a real success, or they've just announced an acquisition that may be really relevant for the conversation you're going to have. So trying to provide insight to people at the point it's relevant to you, which encourages you to go and use the system, gives you value for going to the system, doesn't tax you as part of your job. Because what that leads to is people adopting it. People use the software more if they think they're going to get out of it. And they use it more frequently and more readily and more quickly. And then that's a virtuous circle, because everyone else starts going in the system because they know the data they see is more up to date. It's not a week out of date. They start to see the value immediately to them and much more quickly. Which then actually gives you the thing you're after in the first place, which is the business impact of driving better business change. But you don't get that by slapping people with the stick. You get it by trying to encourage them to gain value themselves and treat it as something that they're going to go in and do. Otherwise, most people will do the bare minimum. And what do we mean by that insight? There are the whole loads of things that we mean by that, which is, what isn't appreciated? What do people not know before they go speak to the customer? They don't know there's a complaint in process. They don't know that they've just done an acquisition. What commonly goes wrong? Where do people make mistakes, and where does it lead to problems? So all those things, if you're aware of those, you can help the user not make them as mistakes and help them feel that it's giving them value. What would make things more efficient? If they can do things in a quarter of the time or avoid broader business impact, that'll help. But driving better capture is also important. A lot of times people, when they do have to capture, I'm not saying you can get away with capture completely, but when you do it in a way that's more meaningful or is easier to do it rather than being a pain to people. But also discovery. We're very good at the moment about knowing as a business lots of information. I'm sure we all see this, where you speak to someone, you find out the meeting you've just gone to, and you come out and vent about it, and you discover that we already knew the challenge that they were raising, just no one had actually told you about it. And the reason they didn't tell you about it was because they didn't know you were going to the meeting. And so trying to have that organizational memory of saying, well, actually, if we can bring that data together and give you that update before you even go in, that'll give you a lot of value. Now, the other one that's interesting about kind of a UX point of view is this is about reducing clicks, right? And trying to get that number of clicks down. Well, not necessarily. I mean, I'm not saying it isn't about reducing clicks, and we do that quite a lot to try and get there. But the more important part of this is about achieving outcomes. If you've got a sales guy that can go in and you make it really efficient for him to make 20 phone calls and he makes one really small sale at the end of the month, well, great. I'd rather have the sales guy that made 3 phone calls and made 3 sales and they were really big sales. So it's not about trying to click him through the user interface, because even if it takes a little bit longer, but you give him the insight, which means he closes bigger and better and more common deals, that's a better outcome for you. In service management, if you can get a user to close off a phone call 5 seconds quicker, well, that's good, and that can save people a lot of money. But if every time that happens, they have to come in for another phone call, you've not necessarily achieved a great deal compared to spending 10 seconds longer, but actually, you close off the call every single time that customer calls in first up. And the customer's more happy, you've saved all the rest of the time that more phone calls will occur, and you've got happier customers, and that leads to overall savings. So one of the other big things we drove around this was understanding what was the actual outcome, and if we can measure that outcome efficiency rather than necessarily just the click-through on the pages, and achieve that more quickly, that's going to drive a bigger impact to the business. And Metrobank found this. We did a lot of work with them, and they found that they were taking a load of inquiries coming through around international payments, but by just spending and forcing the users to work through a few extra steps that took a little bit longer on every call, but they had much lower rates of follow-on calls. They didn't hand it off to the back office and come back and realize they didn't have the information they needed. Every call up front took quite a few more clicks, took a little bit longer, but their overall process dramatically improved and they saved a significant amount in efficiency. So kind of thinking the bigger picture is really where we're seeing around this. The other big one we've done, and you'll see this with things like quick creates versus view forms, is the difference between creating and consuming information. And we did a lot of work of realizing that there's a point where you're creating and entering information, and there's a view point where you're viewing it. And the same user experience doesn't necessarily directly apply to both. So to give you an example of that, this is linked to a customer example I was working with, which was they designed a case form, and they had a requirement given to them by their users of saying, I want a single form for case entry. I don't want multiple forms popping around, I just want a single form. So what they ended up coming up with was quite a complex form with lots and lots of fields on it. So around the contact that was there, they didn't want to launch the contact form. They wanted all the fields on one form. So they had to have all the different fields of how the contact was constructed, all of the address, all the name fields, all in one place on that same form, which is great for entry. But then they also had to have all the bit about the customer. So again, they had all these address forms on there. But now you start looking at that form and say, well, actually, if I come back to this form later and I want to see the case, well, I'm seeing lots of information about addresses and I'm seeing lots of information about the person, but I don't really know what the case is about. And actually, all those things about, for example, whether the customer's a retail customer, might not be. We need to capture it. It's important information for us. And the address is important. It's not going to change how I deal with the case, though. So capturing it, but having all that complexity in the form as a general rule doesn't really necessarily help with the process of dealing with it later. So we did quite a lot of work. Well, sorry, the other part of this was they had to put a lot of customization in that to extract all that information to create the related contact, create the related account behind it, which added to all their complexity for when they upgrade. So we shifted this around. And so we optimized it looking for the new user experience and looking and saying, well, actually, the first thing we can do is start to put some lookups in there and say, actually, I'm going to look across the contact because at the point where I need to capture that information, what I'm going to do is launch a quick create. And that's how we designed it to work. So you can focus on the task at hand, which is to capture the information about the contact. But once that's there, I go back and I just see the full name. I don't need to go into all that other detail. But then the objection comes back, well, there are a couple of fields it's really useful to know about. Well, that's where the quick views come in. So you don't need to see the whole of contact normally, but normally there are a couple of fields like the phone number that you want to quickly click to dial. So we introduced quick views for this reason, which was to let you say, well, actually there's some subtle information you do want to capture. Let's grab that quickly. But now this form, when you go and look at it from a case point of view, I know what the case is about. I've got a quick summary of who the contact is, who's relevant. But I've also got the list of the activities at hand. I know what's happening on that case. And it's a much better experience to come in and look at what's happening from a review point of view. But we didn't damage the creator experience because we captured that in a more structured way using things like quick creates. The other area that we see a lot about is, and I hear this a lot, is we're going to build the system and then I'll figure out how we do some reporting at the end. Because you do the reports off the data we've got, right? So I'll look at that at the end. I haven't had time to do that. And we see that a lot. But I'd step back and say, well, the typical reason for reporting is to say, how successful are we? If you have designed the system and you don't know what your success goals are, how have you designed it to achieve them? How have you worked with your users to say, how am I going to encourage those people to actually achieve those goals of success if I can't even tell them what their goals are? So it's kind of stepping back to saying, well, what is the way we're going to measure the system? What's the way we're going to measure the change that this program is driving if we don't define that up front? Because if we do define that up front, it'll lead us to be able to look at the project and go, well, maybe we want to do something different. If the goal is, for example, on case, first call resolution and getting that as high as possible, well, maybe some of those things about how we manage the case and the insight and using knowledge base is maybe a bit more important than some of the other areas that we're looking at. Because the other part of this is often that reporting is an expensive thing to do. And if you don't know how you're going to report, if you don't know how you're going to measure, how do you know you've got the information to capture that? And I worked on one project recently where they did exactly this. They captured an awful lot of data about everything they did, and then at the end, they decided to try and report on it. But the only way they could get the information they needed to report on was that they'd actually captured all these actions in customer activity, but the key bit of information they wanted to know about was embedded in a bit of text that they put on each of those activities. So the report had to run to go and search the text fields for a bit of text within it across all of the activities in the system. And at about 10 o'clock on every day, when something happened and the performance went through the floor. Strangely, that time was about when the report ran. Go figure. The reality of this is, if you can step back, and what we did there was we went back with them and we said, well, actually, if you can lift out that bit of text and you know you're measuring it, why aren't you capturing that as a specific field? Why aren't you capturing that information? Why can't you break that out? And all of a sudden, by doing that, they actually got their search. The report was better, not only from a performance point of view, but it was more accurate than trying to find that text in the within the text fields. But it ran a heck of a lot quicker as well. And all of a sudden, the users weren't suffering from that. So it's kind of a more material benefit. But like I say, I wouldn't lose from sight from the broader point, which is if you don't know what you're measuring, there are other things you're probably missing to try and drive good experiences. But the other side of this, and the reason we call this business intelligence not reporting, is that it is back to that insight piece. This isn't reporting afterwards to tell you how badly you did in your business, but very much what is the thing that if I could gather that insight and give it to my users, they would do a better job. We as a business would succeed better, and thinking about it from that terms. And again, if you're doing that at the end, you're probably missing a trick, whereas if you do that early on and understand what you're trying to achieve and build that into the system, so in your form designs and in the business process flows you're doing, you're more likely to drive that success. The other one that Darren touched on, so I won't kind of go into a lot of detail, but there's a white paper I wrote this out there that goes into a lot of detail about this, but it's thinking about security from a design point. Quite often, again, this is something that people think about at the end and try and put security on top of it afterwards. But it very much goes back to what Darren was talking about, thinking about the data model. If you know you've got areas you want to offer certain different security controls on, I want to only let the financial information be shown to certain groups of users. Well, why put those fields on the account form when you know that account needs to be seen by everybody? Why not break that out so you've got things like a financial record alongside it? Now, it might sound from a data model point of view that's overkill because you don't need that. But it's not a bad data model. And now you've got the entity model from a security point of view, you can say that certain people can align on that area and not on others. So it's kind of very much linked back to almost the user experience and the security side to be thinking about this right from the start, because you can make your life an awful lot easier and much more aligned to the product, as Darren said, where you don't have to build lots of complex customizations over the top of it, but align and use the product the way it was designed to work to get that benefit. And the way I often think about this is, what would I like to see as a user? What do I think the users would like to see? Which is really about filtering. It's not about they can't see it, it's what would they like to see. What should I be able to see is the next one, which is there is a boundary of the things that I need to be able to see at some point. It might not be right now, but it might be at some point. But just as importantly and differently is what should I not be able to see? And those last two are the ones that often people get confused, is the stuff that they need to be able to see versus the things they couldn't. Because it may well be that there's nothing you shouldn't be able to see, but actually normally you only need to see a certain amount. But there's no reason why you can't see everything. At which point, is a security model of those things even needed? Is this really a user experience and filtering question? Well, I'm going to jump past some of these other bits, just bearing in time. But like I say, all of those things, if you'd like to go into any more detail about that, I've got a scalable security modeling white paper that goes into a lot of details about that. So the other areas about scalability, and I'm going to keep this anonymous to protect the victims of this person, but I don't need to worry about scalability. This is cloud, right? It's just infinitely scalable. I can just throw whatever I like at this and it's just going to handle it. Well, yeah, back in the real world. In the ideal world, yes, but we are still talking about a database at the end of the day, and with CRM in particular, this isn't Azure elastic scalable storage. We are talking about a relational model where we deliberately lock and prevent two people making the wrong change at the same time. Things like service scheduling that deliberately is making sure you can't end up with two people booked at the same time, for example. So there are constraints on that. We use some very big SQL servers, so it's not necessarily the resources of the database server, but things like locking are important. We will still have some contention at the database server. Like I say, if you run a huge, great report with locking designed on it, and there are scenarios where that's important, but if you do that and have locking on it at the same time your users are trying to log on in the morning and take their first calls, you're probably going to get some complaints. So thinking about the impact is still important. You know, there's some great ways to avoid and solve those problems, and we've got some other things coming that will help you solve them even better. But you do need to think about it. You can't just, because it's gone cloud, go, I don't need to worry about this anymore. And also avoiding conflict between requests. And again, there's another paper I've written around the deadlocking, the locking that occurs and ways to avoid it, but that's an impact. Because you need to recognize every time we make a request in CRM, it is doing something in the database. Now that might be reading it without locking. If you do a view, it's just purely retrieving data. There's no major impact. But if you're doing something with reporting that is locking, or if you're updating a record, it will be taking a lock in the database. And every single thing you do like that will be taking a lock on different resources within the database, different objects. Now, the more concurrency you've got, the more batch loads, the more user activity, the more reporting that's going on, the more async that's going on, the more likelihood you've got contention there. If your system only has one user accessing the system every 3 hours, you're not going to run into this one. If you've got lots of people doing things, as most of us do all the time, you're going to start to run into collisions. And what we often see is we're getting timeouts. The platform's broken, you need to fix it. And then when you dig a little bit closer, they're doing a batch load and they're asking for 10,000 requests all in one go, and they're all auto-numbering. And by definition, we need to wait for one to finish to figure out what the next number is, and then wait for the next one to finish to figure out what the next number is. And the more you've got and the more contention there is onto those resources, the more you'll see that eventually there's more things waiting and building up, and eventually we will knock it out as a timeout to stop exactly that scenario, because eventually no one will be able to do anything. So we deliberately have timeouts. But my first reaction to timeouts is generally, there is a chance it's us, but the reality these days is it almost certainly isn't. It's almost certainly something in the way you're constructing your queries, the way you're constructing your actions, that are combining up to causing that timeout. And we will knock out a SQL timeout of 30 seconds. Like I say, I'm not saying it's impossible, it's us. We have had bugs in the past that cause that, but the vast majority of the ones we get pulled into for the last couple of years are things that are now in implementation. And we can help with guidance of how to avoid them, and there's papers out there to do that, but my first reaction, I would say, if you're seeing that, is what am I doing? That's the more likely cause of that. The other one that often catches people out is about async actions. And they often do things where they say, well, I'm doing an async and it'll just run one at a time, so how could that be causing contention? Well, the reality is to get throughput, we don't run them serially. We grab whole batches of them and run them in parallel. So if you, for example, in a batch load have workflow running and you generate a whole load of load in there, the likelihood is we're going to grab them batches of, say, 20 and then try running 20 of them at the same time. So if each of those is doing something contentious, you're going to get that batch content, you're going to get that locking occur. The other big thing we see, and again, this is deliberate because often people want to do this, but you can maintain a transaction across the things you do. So you've got the platform step like create a contact. And if you've got synchronous plugins with synchronous workflows occurring, that transaction will be held open deliberately across the whole thing. So if it fails at any one point, you can roll back the whole thing. But the longer those chain of events occur, the more likely there is that there'll be some contention with something. So the longer your chain of those events, the more likely you can run into problems. So keeping those as short as possible while meeting your business requirements is important. And there is always a friction and a trade-off there between wanting to have that rollback capability versus the cost of having too many things in a chain. And some of that can be only down to only updating the things you need to. And we see some bad patterns of people, for example, thinking, well, it'd be really efficient if every time the user logs on, they can see how many cases they've got assigned to them. So the way I'm going to handle that is I'm going to, every time a case gets created and assigned to somebody, calculate that and store it against the user. Well, that's great up until a user gets given 5 cases and that is updating that multiple times. We cache the user's record on the web server to improve their logon. And every time you update the system user, that's going to flush the cache. And there can be a whole chain of events of those kind of things which can impact things. But actually, the reality is you're updating that flag every single time a case gets created. That user might not come on shift for another 3 hours and would never query those other 4 interim values. It would only be at the end where they first log on and they see 5. So why not query that when they need it in real time at the end, not update it every single time where there's a case created. And things like hierarchies and rollups might be a better way to do that. We calculate some of those things for you. But the other part of this that I come across a lot, which is we're running into a transactionality problem. We're running into a scalability problem. It's like, well, what does your solution do? Can you show me the document? Like, no. Okay, so you don't have a document, that's fine, but can you tell me what you do? What plugins do you have and what fires on what? It's like, Jake knows some of that and Fred knows that other bit of that. And so, okay, so when you sit them down, he knows he's running this thing over here and she knows something else is happening over there and they collide. They've never spoken about those things. For me, that's always a red flag. If you ask for the document that shows the customizations, even at high level, I've got these plugins and they do these things on these events. If you can't show me that document, and worse, if you can't even draw one up for me, I think I know where your problem is coming from. So as a guidance, I would say is, and we see this and we do this all the time, the first thing I would do in these situations is at least draw it down. And it's amazing how many times we solve the problem just by drawing it, and you immediately see the infinite loop. You immediately see the contention. It's not rocket science, but it's amazing how few people do it. The argument you often get, well, you see that this stuff changes over time and we haven't got time to keep it up to date. Like, I would argue you don't have time not to, because that's exactly the scenario where someone adds another layer and adds another layer and adds another layer. How do you know that that's not impacting on something earlier? I would argue that's exactly the time you need to make the time to draw this up so that you do know what impact you're going to have before you make that change. So on that note, hopefully we've given you an idea of some of the kind of more significant problems we see and some of the scope of the things of trying to design these things in from the start and get these things working from the start and trying to avoid some of these problems. You know, Darren's talked about some of the approach things, more kind of project holistics, try and give you a guidance of some of the things we've seen that help you get things right from the start. And if anything, I would leave you that thought about cloud, which is it's not really about cloud, it's about agility. And if even if you're not going, please think about that and please start driving towards that so that you're ready for it, or you're more importantly, you're ready for the agility of upgrades anyway. But on that note, we're open for questions, and as Darren says, we're happy to hang around if there's anything you'd like to talk about beyond that as well. So, has anyone got any questions? Actually, could you go grab the mics just because it'd be on the recording, so it'd be useful for others and for people not here at the event.
So this question goes back to the values that you said can be added by going to the cloud, or
yep.
CRM online, like new features. So do you have any strategies or the problems you've seen with customers, with new features that they want to use but don't know how or don't want to use at all?
So I think this, if I understand the question, I guess there's a couple of areas. I mean, do we see challenges around people who want to use features and don't know how? Absolutely. And I think it's one of the roles of our team, actually, is to try and recognize some of those scenarios, which is why you'll see things like that UX white paper, because I think one of the things we saw was, we know why we've done it. I don't think we articulated clearly enough why we did it to try and get people to change with those things. So there are two kind of responses to that. Some of it is our team's role is to talk back to the PM team to say, you kind of missed a trick of educating of how to go about that. Or I've done another one on things like process flows where, yes, people knew what it was for and how to use it, but there were some interesting edge cases or gotchas to watch for. So our team's kind of got two roles of trying to feed that back where we've missed those. But the second one is really trying to say, well, if there is a bit of guidance from experience of, you know, we didn't see that people would try and use it that way, but some really useful ideas or some really useful guidance we can get out there. That's one of the reasons for our team's existence, which is to try and take some of that feedback and get it back out there. But hopefully we learn from it to reduce the likelihood in the next occurrence of that. In terms of not wanting to use the features, yes. And I think what you'll probably see more of, and I probably hopefully have seen more recently, is we do a lot more opt-in type stuff. So if you look at field service, if you look at project service, if you look at portals, all that stuff isn't cluttering up your instance unless you want it. And we're moving to those kind of models of saying, we recognize that not everyone will want to use everything. And in particular, we recognize that not everyone will want it immediately. So buying you the time to choose when you deploy it will give you a lot more freedom of that. So we are, I'm not saying perfectly, but we are trying to address it in those kind of ways of letting you opt in when you're ready for things.
Right, because at the end of the day, it's user adoption.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm, you know, if at some point new features are released that do, you know, interfere with their daily tasks,
yeah.
At some point, you know, there are going to raise questions.
Yeah.
So just looking for strategies as to how better, you know, help user adoption.
Yeah, no, I think to that point, I think we're very conscious of that. We're actually having conversations right now about what else we could do to try to make sure we're there. Because what we are trying to balance, though, is we don't want you to not upgrade because of those things. We want you to upgrade to the point that you could choose to adopt them when you're ready. We just don't want that to conflict with you or impact with you in that period in between. And I think that's the balance point. We want you to be there so you can, but make sure that you can do that when you want to and when you're ready for it. No worries. Is there anything else? That was an easy one. I'll go for it. Good, otherwise, either we answered everything or we bored you all into sleep, and I'm not sure which.
This is Q from Dell. The question kind of piggybacks back on what you guys talking about in terms of moving from, you know, on-premise to the cloud. Obviously, there's a conversation of pros and cons, right, for going there or not going there.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of things that is a challenge when you go to the cloud or stay online. One is the roll-ups and updates that happen that you have to do at some point. So obviously, you know, if you're on the Office is not compatible or Windows OS is not compatible as well, you know, those kind of things. Yeah. How are you guys addressing that challenge of the infrastructure that we have is not really ready for the roll-up or online? So I just would like your input on that.
Okay, so let's break that down, because I think if we're talking about update rollups in particular, they shouldn't impact any of that. The reality of those is that they don't impose a new prerequisite. So you're not going to get suddenly I'm dropping support for Internet Explorer in an update rollup. The only time we would do something like that is in a major release, and we make that really clear for that reason. So we're not going to suddenly drop those things out. Other accidental ones, occasionally that introduces a bug that's related to that. But I often hear that, and I'm not attacking your question, I understand where you're coming from with this, but I often hear that argument with that model, which is, well, it might introduce something. And the best example of that I can see is actually with one of the big European banks, who is avoiding doing updates. They're back on 2011, update 11, because of the risk of change that might break them. We've had three critical outages at that bank that were fixed in update rollups that have been out for over a year. At what point do you step back and go, when did we actually break you by upgrading versus the three outages you've actually had that were due to things that we've already fixed? It's often very, we see that a lot, which people do remember the problem way longer than the things that they fix, and they don't realize the 12 other outages they would have had if they had upgraded and never saw. And so particularly around the update roll-ups, I think the stats are really strongly in favor of saying, yeah, there may be sometimes we got it wrong. And I think if you go back about 3 years, we had a bad state with some of the update roll-ups. If you look over the last 2 years, I think it's been negligible, the problems we've had. I'm not saying they're not important, but we have had some. But they're much more marginal in terms of the volumes. And I would argue very strongly that the things we've saved people for way outnumber the things that we've hurt people with. And so particularly update roll-ups, we see it so much, which is people get hit by things that we've already fixed a long time ago. And so update rollups in particular, I would say you're definitely not staying up to date on those. The risk of taking them is way lower than the risk of not taking them. So I think the bigger part you're talking about is the prerequisites and as things change. And I do recognize that's a difficult challenge. I think one of the other things we're seeing, though, is that most of the places people run into that, they're actually out of support on the software they did anyway. So we hit a problem where people say, well, you're not willing to support us. If we upgrade to this, you're not willing to support us on Exchange 2003. Well, you're not supported on Exchange 2003 anyway, and the security implications of being on Exchange 2003 are huge. Are we really the problem there, you know, in that sense? And I know there's a middle ground in the middle there somewhere, and I know things like we have to kind of depend on some of the other things that are happening within the broader Microsoft. So things like Internet Explorer, you know, only supporting the latest release on a particular OS has an impact on people, and we get that, and that is a challenge for people of staying up to date. But particularly if you look at some of those things, that's for a reason, which is the browser is so central to your connection to the internet, and there are so many security changes, so many security enhancements coming that way. Do you really want to be behind on some of those things? And so I think what we're almost trying to do as a company around there is trying to drive people to be more up to date anyway, because people are so tied with their hands behind the back because of history. And I think what we're seeing with most organizations that they were stuck on things like XP or or kind of, you know, those operating systems of that kind of era and versions of Outlook there a long time ago, as they're leaping to more virtualized desktops in bigger deployments, they're able to stay more current because they don't want to stay unsupported anymore. They don't want exceptions about being on unsupported software. So we are seeing that kind of switch flicking, which is, as people move forward, they're now getting to a more supported model with a kind of pattern of staying more supported, which lets us then work with them. So they're less likely to fall off our support matrices because we're aligned with that. Will it happen? I can't guarantee there's no scenarios like that, but I think that's our thinking of where we're at, and it's actually in people's interest to try and move forward, and we can only help encourage people in their own interest to stay there. Okay. No one else is asking, so you may as well get your money's worth.
So I'm kind of curious, like you said, you're moving towards, aiming for something that, you know, with new features you could turn on or off, yep. Use them. So this, you know, goes to, you know, all the information about Cortana Intelligence and other things that you're integrating with the new upgrade, with
yep.
The tiles. So is that something that would fit into the category of something you could turn on or off just as easily?
Yep. And in most cases, for example, if you break out those things, what are they? There is a feed of data out into those areas, and then there's the ability to do that analysis and insight on that data, and that the ability to pull it back. Now, if I break those out, one of the things we have already done for Mocha Offline and for Search is we've got a data extraction service that pulls data out of CRM and then distributes it to all the places that you've signed it up to be sent to. If you've signed up to Search, it'll feed out to Search. If you're using Mocha Offline, it'll feed it out to that kind of mechanism. The advantage of that is we've only got one drain on the CRM OLTP system that's pulling data out in one go. Therefore, the framework's there, but until you turn any of them on, we're not pulling the data out. And until you decide that you want to move forward, it's not going there. So yes, in that sense, that's an always-on extract.
So it's modular.
Yes, it's absolutely modular, yep. And it gives us an ability of scale, it gives us an ability of making the most of the impact. But then whether you surface that insight back or you just look at it over in that other place, again, is a choice for you. It may be you do ML over somewhere else and you extract it, but you don't show it to users because you're not forced to give that user interface to people. So, yeah, with things like that in particular, you've got that ability to kind of build on that framework out there and choose where you deploy it.
Have you ever run across a situation where cost becomes a barrier of entry for online? So we have some customers that have enormous databases and they have millions of transactions and they want to stay on-prem to control that cost. We also have customers where we have to write a lot of plugins to move attachments over to Azure and there's just pointers in CRM online, for example. So just curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yes is a simple answer. And I think there are some that we need to work a little bit harder on, and the attachments and the storage one is a good one. And I think our answer at that at the moment is, yeah, the better place to put that would be SharePoint, and the SharePoint storage is a lower cost storage. OLTP rapid relational database with the storage we've got for that kind of use does not come with the optimal cost model for that volume of documents, and we get that. We get it, and it's something we're aware of. I think in the short term, though, the answer for that is move that out to SharePoint. There's various different approaches people have used for that one. The activities is an interesting one, though, and I think there's a kind of reaction back I've seen on a lot of cases there, and I kind of go, why? And we've seen people, I know the worst case one I saw was one of the credit card companies who was saying, I want to move all of my activities into CRM, because when my users go into CRM, they look at that customer, they want to see the credit card transactions, or 43 billion of them. I was like, no. No, we are not doing a billion per night. We couldn't, but we shouldn't. And I think if you break that scenario down, I look at it and I would challenge, if you're putting so much data in your storage and the throughput is a problem, you probably want to be asking whether you should be in the first place. The other classic one that I see is every single night putting the balance in for every account into the system. And then why can't you put 50 million in every night? Well, again, should you? What does that do to your audit? What does that do to your workflows? I think there's a lot of patterns like that I see where I would come back and go, the challenge the need you've really got is to make that data available to the users. That doesn't necessarily mean it needs to be sat in CRM. Now, I get that we more commonly work better with data in CRM, and having the concept there, having the product holding in there makes clear sense. But if you only actually see 1% of view, 1% of your product holdings per day, do you want to be updating 100% of them every day? Or actually, a couple of models, would you be better off going and pulling that in on demand or having a mashup to show the product balances that therefore doesn't have to be held in CRM? The other one I've seen is when you actually dig into the details, people go, for example, and say the balances and say, what I really want to know is when people have got have gone into a new tax threshold of, say, over $50,000, for example. Well, I don't need to update that in CRM every day so that you can run a query to go if anything's over 50,000. In my ATL process, I can work out whether someone's changed to go over 50,000 and update that 1% that's changed. So then I can run any very easy process to go show me all the ones that have changed status. So I think there's lots of those kind of strategies I see, which is really kind of go and challenge, do you need all that data in there? Sometimes there are, but more often than not, there's another way to handle that, particularly if you are balancing against some of the other consequences.
Besides looking at SharePoint, they're going to be moving to Azure Storage. There's a little bit more work need to do. Right? You have to actually look at the cost. But I mean, I've specifically looked into what is our roadmap for Dynamic CRM. I don't want to promise any timelines, but we're definitely evaluating, you know, the attachment problem, because it's not the current solution is you have to move it out, right? But I mean, CRM's database is a premium storage. You pay $10 per gigabyte, right, per month for additional storage. So going back, that's the current solution for your attachment problem. But going back to your questions related to, you have millions and millions of records in the CRM database, right? Depends on what type of record and see what type of value that the customers, the end users are looking for, right? That goes back to your analysis phase, right? If you're going to be trying to move yourself from on-premise to online, right, in the SIBO world, customers, they have 10 to 20 years of data in there. They just leave it in the database, right? But if you're going to be looking at migrating something that's on-prem to online, you have to look at the amount of data that you actually bring to online, right? What's valuable? And then when you're actually migrating to online, you might just only migrate the necessary data, right? And then work with your customer, come up with an archiving strategy up front, right? That's the thing that you will have to do, because I work with customers. Like, archiving is not only just getting records out of CRM, there's a lot of meaning to archiving, right? And you have to actually access the records, right? And you actually move out of CRM, how you can actually link to the record back to CRM. Those things that you need to look at, but I mean, there are archiving strategies. You can actually move out the data out and purge it. So I mean, that's the way that we're handling those problems with our, you know, large customers. They have a lot of data, but I think that, you know, you just set the expectation up front with them. You know, how long of data are you gonna actually set, put in CRM? Maybe a year, maybe 2 years. Right, and then you have to actually do a projection, right? When you actually work with the customer and see how much data they're going to be, growing in the CRM system, and then define and plan to see how we're going to move it out. That's the strategy, and
so
that's.
With an archival strategy, do you use like a scribe dump into a local database or something like that?
Kingsway's off. You can actually retrieve the data, right? And then you can actually move the data out to your data warehouse. I think in the preview program, we're going to have our, data sync framework.
Yeah.
And then you can actually move the data to SQL Azure, and then you can actually, slowly do Power BI against it. So I think that's going to be, helping you with that problem.
And that's a broader pattern solution we're looking at, is where's the right place for the data. And so we're looking at things like Cortana Analytics Suite and being able to store things in a data lake there where there's huge volume. Internet of Things is another angle where we're looking to say, well, actually, that kind of thing is the place for that kind of data, not in CRM. But then we can make it seamless that you can view it. So it's about trying to get the right place, the right storage.
Okay.
Yeah.
Norris?
I have a question about the security.
Okay.
I see a lot of security model on the front end, but ultimately the data stored in the database is not that secure. Like, we have sensitive data, like data codes, sensitive security numbers. But when I query the CRM database tables, it's not like everyone is having an access to see those data, who are having permission to database. Like, our DBAs have permissions to see the data, but not like CRM users have, like we have securities, but on the database level, a lot of fields which is not secure. But I see few fields like data encryption is applied for, like out of the box field, But if you have a security for like custom fields on the database level, is there any plans going on to secure those fields?
So I think you may be missing something. And I think the key was the word is your administrators can see this. Yes, your administrators can see that because they're administrators. They have access to that. The way through, if we break this down, if you're talking about direct database access, you're talking about on-prem. And we have filtered views, which is how things like reports can get to the database. We've got, we had filtered views for the old days where things like Excel could go to there. And those filtered views honor your entire security model. So if I can only see five records and I go to that filtered view, that's all I can see is the five records I can do. We completely honor the security model, even to the database when we're using those filtered views. And guess what, if you're an end user, the only bits of the database you've got access to is those filtered views. We do not grant you access to the rest of it. What you're talking about is the administrator, but the administrator, by definition, has to have access to everything because he's administrating the database. He needs to run cleanup tasks, he needs to run indexes. So you're right, the administrator can access everything, but that doesn't mean the database isn't secure. The database is completely secure. You can either grant a more restricted role into the database for someone who does other tasks that need to see more broad use and then limit it down how you'd like, or you grant it as a normal user. And if they just go in as a normal user, they won't be able to see anything that they can't see through the UI. So I would challenge your statement that it's a UI level security. No, we follow that security model. The whole stack, if you follow the normal security model, the only potential that you're seeing there is an administrator who has to, yes, can see everything because he absolutely has to be able to do the administration.
Just to add to what Roger is saying, what you're talking about is the on-premise world, or you're taking a copy of online and back to your on-premise and do a data analysis, right? And then we do support, if on on-premise world, we do support SQL TDE, right, encrypted database. In the online world, you are not able to access the database at all. So everything you're going to be accessed online is going to do the web service API.
The reason why I'm asking is like, so Picard and Microsoft ticket, and they want to see our database, and they actually, the database which we are trying to ship it to Microsoft is having like all plain text unsecured information like data words or something.
You should encrypt it before you ship it to us. And then usually when you open a ticket, and then our premier team usually give you a secure FTP site, and whatever upload that you upload to that site is encrypted.
I mean, the problem with that is that the reason they do that is that sometimes it is data that's causing the problem. Now, when they take that database, it will be kept in a very secure set of servers and for a limited lifetime, and the second they're finishing that case, they'll delete it. So we handle those scenarios in other ways. In the same way, we're really open about it. If you're online, our administrators can come and see your data. They don't, and we have very strict control, so they don't on just for the sake of it. But if they need to, they can go in and do it, because if they need to fix up things, if they need to apply indexes, if they need to upgrade you, we do need the access to be able to do that. So I would very carefully separate that administration use from normal use. The administrator has to have data to do their job. That's the unfortunate reality of life.
Yeah, in the online world, I mean, both Roger and I are not able to actually access your database.
No. And then the people I have to go and ask the support guy to ask, because the service guy to get it quite deliberately.
People who are accessing it, right, and they have background checks on everybody. So, I mean, they have a special access to your online database. So, I mean, not everyone can get access to it.
I'm just conscious of time. So, I mean, we'll be around if anyone has any follow-up. So feel free to come along. But thank you very much for coming. And please fill in the surveys to let us know what you thought.
Thanks.